Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host, journalist Holly Rubinstein, and here each week I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today we're uncovering another favourite episode from the Travel Diaries archive, now that we have over 100 episodes to pick from, as we build up to our big season finale with Joanna Lumley next week. It was so hard to choose, but when I reflected on the episodes that sparked the most wanderlust in me from the most seasoned travellers, I thought it had to be Ben Fogel this week. Ben's episode was recorded back in the COVID days during season 3, when no one really knew what was going on with the future of travel. And his tales of epic physical feats, wilderness living, going to the most remote parts of the planet really inspired me. So let's hear a bit more about him now. Ben is not only an award-winning broadcaster, fronting many of our most loved TV shows, he is also one of the UK's most prolific adventurers. He has rowed across the Atlantic Ocean, swam from Alcatraz to San Francisco, run the Marathon des Sables, a six-day ultra-marathon across the Sahara Desert, raced across Antarctica to the South Pole, and most recently climbed Mount Everest. It makes me exhausted just thinking about it. He's written 9 best-selling books, many about travel, and has the enviable title of the United Nations Patron of the Wilderness. And speaking of the wilderness, he's travelled to every corner of the globe while filming his long-running hit TV series, New Lives in the Wild, a notion that feels particularly relevant right now and one that we'll discuss on today's episode. And while Ben himself doesn't live in the wild, he does live in a house that's off-grid without broadband. So this was a truly remote recording and means the sound is maybe a little less crisp than the rest of the season coming up. So are you ready to be transported to Guatemala, Ethiopia, Bolivia, the top of Mount Everest, the Canadian wilderness, and Iron Appa? Here are the travel diaries of Ben Fogel. Ben, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. It's a rather strange time, isn't it, for people who travel, having had such a long period of non-travel. So I think it's actually rather apt that this is the perfect kind of time to reflect and to revisit places in our minds and words and in podcasts. I think that's what I've used this period of lockdown for, to sort of reminisce, reflect, something that I don't usually have time to do.
Yes, because your life and work is travel. It is so deeply connected to travel. And now you've been locked down for months, unable to travel. So how has that been for you?
Well, I don't want to be insensitive to those who have struggled with lockdown and the economic and health impact that's had, but actually it's been incredible for me. For the last 20 years, I have never had more than one consecutive week at home. So suddenly to have had, in my case, it's almost been 12 weeks, I think, maybe even a little longer, with my family in our home, not leaving the perimeter, has actually been a really valuable lesson for me. I think, believe it or not, I might be one of the first guests you've had on here who actually might conclude that maybe I've traveled a bit too much. When I say that, to try and explain why, I think too much of anything isn't necessarily a good thing, because it doesn't really give you the opportunity to really enjoy and maximize what you have. And I think this period at home with my family has given me the opportunity of not only really getting to know them, which I know sounds a bit strange, but this is the longest time I've ever spent with my wife consecutively, and certainly with my own children. And that's all because of the travel, which is my oxygen, my passion, my work, my life. I really consider myself a journeyman, and a journeyman rarely stops, but I've suddenly had that opportunity, and it's it's been rather magical.
Oh, that's lovely. It's so nice to hear the positive stories from this time. And as you say, a gift of an opportunity to get to spend that time with your family. So for years, we watched you document the experiences in different kinds of isolation in far-flung places on your TV series, New Lives in the Wild, some who are completely self-sufficient. Has the pandemic given you an even greater appreciation for their way of life, would you say?
It has. You know what's really strange, Holly, is that 20 years ago, this year was where I kind of really started my career when I was marooned on an island for a year. It was one of the early sort of reality shows, and the idea was that a group of volunteers were sent to live for a whole year. Mm-hmm. This is what a lot of people forget. It was actually 13 months on and off in the Outer Hebrides. And it was much more than a game show. It wasn't really a reality show, although I suppose it was in TV terms, but it was about self-sufficiency. It was about creating an off-grid life, being less dependent on the outside world, being more resourceful. And after that year, it gave me a huge amount of confidence. It empowered me because I always thought, in the event of a zombie apocalypse or a global pandemic, that's where I would go for my isolation. I'd scoop up my family. We would go at top speed all the way up to Scotland, and we would then decamp to an island where I would use all those skills. And of course, now I'm talking to you 12 weeks later from my very civilized home in Oxfordshire, where I live with my family. And I'm not there. I'm kind of isolated from the isolation. So there's a great irony, really, that I always thought that that's how I'd live. And
did you consider actually trying to get up to Tarensay? Did you consider going?
Yes, but it would. Do you know what? I didn't have the materials that you would need. You know, that when reality hits, when reality bites, you actually suddenly realize your fallibilities and your vulnerabilities. So although I'm perfectly happy and safe in the knowledge that I could build some, you know, shelter for my family and I could grow all the crops, you still need the basic materials to get that going. And we just didn't have, you know, it wasn't going to happen. And as we have seen, you know, visitors were suddenly not really welcome in those faraway remote communities. And I get that. It probably wouldn't have gone down a southern family suddenly turning up. So I think actually it was probably sensible that we didn't do that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But of course, I've tried to create an element of that here in Oxfordshire. So half the garden has been turned over to a veg patch, which I've been kind of itching for an excuse to do. So we're now growing a huge amount of our own produce, and we've severed ourselves from the grid here. We've got heat exchange systems. We've got solar panels. So we're trying to be a little bit off-grid in a kind of built-up, civilized part of the country.
Amazing. Okay, let's get started with your travel diaries, kicking off with chapter one, which is your earliest childhood travel memory.
That would have to be Canada. So I'm actually half Canadian. I know it doesn't sound it, but I can put on a Canadian accent if you want. I don't spend a huge amount of time there, so I'll stick with my English one. Dad is a fully paid up, plaid shirt wearing, moose lamp owning Canadian canoe, paddling Canadian. He wears the maple leaf. Anyone that's been to Canada and has met Canadians traveling will know they always have the maple leaf flag on their rucksack. They wear a little lapel badge just in case they get mistaken for an American, which is
yeah,
the worst sin you can ever make, to think that a Canadian might possibly be their southerly neighbors. But no, so Canada was a big part of my childhood. My sisters and I would go there every single summer for the full 8-9 weeks, where we'd spend time at grandma and grandpa's cottage on a lake. It was the quintessential kind of Canadiana. It was a hand-built cottage that grandpa had built himself.
Where in Canada was that?
It was in Ontario, just outside, about 2 hours southwest of Toronto, in a lake region called the Kawarthas. And it was a specific lake called Lake Chemung, and I loved Lake Chemung. It was it was my happiest place. I cried for days when it was time to return home, because the flip side of that was that I grew up in central London. And when I say central London, I could see Marble Arch from my bedroom window. The nearest kind of green space was Hyde Park, which was my kind of my access to the wilderness, or the, as much as close to that as I was going to get. So Canada really was escapism, and it was all swimming, canoeing, fishing, building dens, going camping, exploring, and I loved it. I can't tell you how much I loved Canada. It still brings me great nostalgia just to think about it. There are smells that take me back there, and it was a huge part of who I am.
Mm. And did that spark your love and interest in the wilderness?
I think so. I mean, it wasn't wilderness in the kind of contemporary sense. There were lots of very civilized, I keep using this word, there were lots of very comfortable cottages on the lake. Like I say, it was quite rustic how we lived there. But it was just a place that gave me great comfort. And as we grew a little bit older, Dad started taking us exploring. He wanted us to know Canada. So we did the quintessential tour of the West Coast in an RV, a recreational vehicle. Dad took some colossus sort of 50-meter monster. I'm obviously exaggerating there, but it really didn't look like that at the time. Couldn't get into any city or town centers. Always had to park it in parking lots because it was too big. It was too big for most of the camping sites, but it had showers and bunk beds, and it was amazing. And as soon as I started exploring Western Canada, so kind of British Columbia and Vancouver, I think that's when my horizons started to grow, that there was more than just London and Lake Chemung when it came to travel. And then we'd start traveling around Ontario to Algonquin Park. Again, some of your listeners who know Canada will know this is a great wilderness where they really limit the number of people in there. We'd go camping in canoes, portaging where you carry it between lakes, and watching moose and beaver and diving for freshwater clams. And it really, it was magical. And I love that momentum of travel. And I think that's probably where the seed of travel was really formed.
You're so right about momentum. When people say travel is escapism, I actually think it's more about contrast in a way. Was that the same for you?
I think contrast is really important. I think we all want contrast. I think if you live in a wild urban place, to suddenly go to the middle of New York or the center of Paris is a great, exciting experience because it's different. And I think travel is all about embracing what you don't normally have. And for me, that is what kind of Canada and the wilderness has always done. Growing up in such a gritty urban place, it was the height of the IRA troubles. There were bombs on the streets. There were police cars closing roads. It was kind of, I mean, again, I don't want to sound glib, it was kind of exciting, but it was really urban and gritty. Our dogs, Dad's a vet. I grew up above his veterinary clinic, and to walk the dogs, we'd walk them in the gutter.
Gosh.
And they'd squat down behind cars, and they'd get exhaust pipe fumes on the back of their fur. I'm giving you that example because I just want to reiterate just how urban my upbringing was. And then suddenly to be in Algonquin Park was like going on to Mars, and I just loved it. And I've always thought, and I think my travel diaries all the way up to where I am now have led me to believe that's where we belong, not really in urban areas. We have a great affinity and connection with the natural world. It's a much more honest lifestyle, and I think that honesty appealed to me from a very early age.
So from life's lessons to life's loves, Chapter 2 is the first place you fell in love with.
I think, well, it's a pretty big region. It's Latin America. So we're just picking a tiny little corner of the world.
Yeah.
But I was 19. I had just failed all my A-levels. I didn't know I had failed them yet. It was that little period just after you've taken the A-levels. I had a sense that it hadn't gone well. But I was in that honeymoon period, and I went on for my gap year. And which turned into two, by the way. And Latin America for me was the great unknown. I'd always loved geography. I did a lot of kind of finger traveling, open up a map, an atlas, and I would just kind of wander around the world. And Latin America was this huge area I knew nothing about. The places were largely alien to me. I'd hardly heard of the capital cities. And if you think about it, it's a symptom of our geography. So if you live in America, North America, that is, then obviously you hear a great deal about South America. But for us, we tend in Great Britain, we'd hear quite a lot about the continent of Africa being our closest large, exciting continent beyond Europe. South America was this mystery. So when I got the opportunity to travel, I literally opened up an atlas, stuck my finger down, and it landed on Ecuador. Never even heard of Ecuador, Quito, the capital, and I thought, that's where I'm going to go. So I worked out how I could get there, what I would do. I ended up finding a placement where I'd live with a family and teach in a school, and I obviously kind of incorporated that with a great journey from Brazil up the Amazon through Peru, Bolivia, doing all the kind of typical gap year things, going to Machu Picchu and up the Amazon and to Lake Titicaca, all of those things. And I just loved it. I mean, honestly, when I say I loved it, that's an understatement. It was the most exciting continent. And I know I don't want to kind of use big brush strokes when we talk about areas or regions or countries, but Latin America as a whole just filled me with so much excitement. The smells, the colors, the riches, the people, the history, the literature, everything was amazing. And I found myself immersing myself in every Gabriel Garcia Marquez book and Isabel Allende. And I couldn't get enough of it. And I actually ended up studying a degree in Latin American studies.
Oh, really?
It gave me an even better understanding of this exciting region.
And for people who haven't visited Latin America, myself included, where would you say would be a good starting point to get their first flavor of the region as a whole?
Well, I think if we then break Latin America up into kind of Central and South, I think if you're going to go to Central America, Guatemala is just an amazing, amazing place, full of the cultures that you want and the riches and the landscape and the beauty. There's a place called Antigua, which is where a lot of foreigners go. You can go and learn Spanish there. It's overlooked by a big smoldering volcano. It's the quintessential, if you're going to make a film, and a lot of films have been made in that region, but that's where you would probably want to go. So I'd say Guatemala. Obviously, you'd always have to check with the FCO about the current state of safety and the politics there. It's quite a vulnerable region, full stop. But I think Guatemala for Central America, and if South America, I'd go for Bolivia. I returned there last year for the first time in quite a period, and it didn't disappoint. I found it so exciting. The variety of landscapes that you've got there, from Salar de Uyuni, these big salt flats. You've got access to the Amazon region. You've got the high Andes. You've got the indigenous culture, and you've got the high lakes of like Lake Titicaca. And for me, I just think that those are two very, very exciting regions.
Wow, what a great recommendation. It sounds like a condensed version of the best bits of South America in one country. And it's a nice contrast, actually, to the typical recommendations of Brazil, Argentina. So with that in mind, lots of itineraries try and cover the full region, vast region. But like Bolivia, each country has so much to offer.
Absolutely. And you know, my advice to travellers who are looking to explore different areas is don't necessarily do what I do, which is to try and see everything and every single bit, because actually what I've discovered after nearly three decades of travelling now is that actually I find myself revisiting places just so that I can properly understand them and properly reach all the corners. I think it's if you spread yourself too thin with the travel and you want to go to multiple places and hit all those big tourist points, actually it's to the detriment of really getting to know a region. And there's no better way to get to know a region, by the way, than the people. I'm a big people traveler. I feel a lot of modern travel misses the point, but actually you'll never ever have a better travel experience than if you are with some locals somehow, whether they're guides, whether they're friends, whether they're people that you're living with, staying with, eating with, it's easily the best way to really get to know a place, a region, a country.
It's the people that make the place.
Oh, for sure. I think it took me a long time to reach that point. I think I was very literal with my travel in the early stages, that it was all about going to Angkor Wat, or it was all about going to Machu Picchu, or to the pyramids. It was about going to wonder.
Ticking places off.
Yeah, that was my assumption. And of course, you want to see those regions, but actually you get a much, much better travel experience if you are actually with locals, and those experiences which have happened serendipitously, accidentally or proactively, where I've been with locals, have inevitably been my favorite travel experiences.
And I read that you visited more than 100 islands. Is that right?
I've become a bit of an island fanatic. My year on Tarense for the Castaway experiment, I think my first island experience was when I was about 8 years old, and I went to the island of Rum in the Inner Hebrides. And I think from there, yeah, I've just become fascinated, really fascinated. And I'm not, it probably sounds to lots of your listeners who might not know about all of my travel, it might sound like a lot of it is box ticking, but it's not. So when I say 100 islands, it's not like I have earmarked off island after island I want to go to, but they really fascinate me. And a lot of them have been very hard to get to. Islands like Pitcairn and Tristan da Cunha and St. Helena. They're the islands that really, really excite me. The Falkland Islands, I've been lucky enough to go out there a number of times. And I love the fact that they're kind of microcosms of the wider society. Everything is magnified, and you get almost a richer experience when you go to an island.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn, when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. So Pitcairn Island, I was particularly interested in. It's in the South Pacific. And am I right in thinking it's the least populated territory in the world?
Well, there's 36 islanders who live there. It was settled by the mutineers from the Bounty after they cast Captain Bligh adrift several hundred years ago. They needed to find somewhere where they would settle. So they're all the descendants of Christian Fletcher and his team of mutineers. There's no airport. There's no boat service. When I got there, I went about 19 years ago, I found a Frenchman who had a sailboat called the Sauvage, and he and I sailed for 7-8 days across the Southern Ocean. Terrifying journey. Just the two of us. And actually, when we got there, I didn't have the correct paperwork. I got arrested and deported after about an hour. So it was
So it wasn't that much of an in-depth experience then.
No, it wasn't an in-depth experience, but it gave me, I've still got a fascination for that island. And actually, I'd like to return one day. I need to give myself a huge amount of time to get back there. And it's actually one of the places that has disappointed me the most in terms of not being able to get there, leaving me with a slight bitter taste on how I was treated. But I get it. It's an island that is very much a reflection, I suppose, of its history.
And if you do have the right paperwork, is it a place that is now any easier for tourists to get to, or is it still a long sailing trip to reach it?
Well, you can, I know a couple of the cruise ships that do the southern, the South Pacific do stop off there. Whether how many people can get ashore, I'm not entirely sure right now. So it is still a very difficult place, but if you are on the right journey and on the right boat, you can still get there. But certainly there's no regular easy way to get there. I would probably still mark it off as one of the more complex places to get to. I've got a handful of places. When people say, what are the most difficult places to get to, which are the kind of most, the most precious in terms of just how complex it is, Pitcairn would be up there with some of the more remote places.
What would some of the others be?
I think Siberia. What I don't think I've ever tried. It took 4 days of travel, endless aeroplanes, endless waiting. I was right up in the northeast corner, very, very close to Alaska, actually. I was probably about 150 miles as the crow flies from Alaska, which is pretty extraordinary. And arguably, it would have been easier had I gone through North America. But obviously, you can't cross the line from that direction. So I had to travel the other way. And honestly, this place, I actually went to this place called the Pleistocene Park, one of the most exciting places. This is a group of Russian scientists who are trying to bring back the woolly mammoth. Long story. I don't think we've got time to go into it, but they have created the most astonishing sort of prehistoric park in one of the most isolated places I've ever been. So that would be another one. Papua New Guinea, you can obviously get to it relatively easily in terms of getting to Port Moresby, but once you then want to venture further afield, it becomes a little bit more complex. East Timor, another place that's pretty exciting. But yeah, I think a number of those regions would be included in my not easy to get to black book. Well, because of the kind of preciousness of filming, so the New Lives in the Wild, we usually have about 2.5 weeks or so to get there, film, and get out, which might sound like a long time, but it's really not, especially when you've got 3 or 4 days of travel just to get to the place, which is often the case, because even if we're filming in a relatively easily accessible place like Thailand, for example, it's then often another 48-hour journey just to get to the remote part. So when as soon as the plane lands or the train arrives or the minibus we're on or the 4x4 reaches our place, we start rolling. There's no buffer zone, and I just get on with it. I think I've done it so much. I probably traveled 9 months of each year. Goodness knows how much of that is spent in the traveling part, as in, you know, on the journey to get to the region. Probably the majority, to be honest. And I'm pretty good with my own company. I read a lot. I do a lot of writing while I'm on the road. I chat a lot. I look a lot. I take photos. So I do. I just take traveling in my stride. When I see that I've got a 5-day journey ahead of me, that's, you know, another pretty complex region to get to is northeastern Amazonia. And I went there last year, and that included a 48-hour non-stop boat journey. When you have those, I don't kind of roll my eyes and think, oh no, because the journey is part of the travel, isn't it, really? I suppose it's the old cliched saying that the destination, it's not all about the destination. The journey is a part of what you were, you know, experiencing.
I still can't get over 9 months of traveling. Wow. With all your reading, writing, photography, you obviously learn a lot when on the road. So that leads me on to chapter 3, which is the trip where you learned the most about yourself.
Blimey. Well, that's probably the Atlantic Ocean. It's not really a place, is it? It's a vast part of the planet. But I rode across it 15 years ago with my friend, the Olympic rower, James Cracknell. We were in a tiny little rowing boat, 23 feet long. And that was the period of growth that changed me as a person. I learned about boredom. I learned about tolerance. I learned about pain, suffering, fear, all of those things. We really were alone on that huge ocean in this tiny little boat. And I think I learned a lot about just confronting a lot of fears that perhaps we try to shield ourselves from. And those fears are, you know, everything from failure to hunger to sorrow to the emotions of missing people. All of those things were part of that extraordinary experience. We were at sea for 49 days. And I think it was a time and a place. I think if I did it again, it wouldn't be quite such a good tutor or teacher. I think it was exactly the right time in my life when I needed to learn those lessons. I had started in the public eye. I was a very, very minor celebrity. Some would argue I still am. but I was, you know, I really was, you know, the posh bloke who'd been on a reality show, who was doing a bit of daytime TV. And I think it was just that sweet point where I could have got a bit carried away with how my star was. Fortunately, I've always had a family that have kept me firmly grounded. But I think that experience was one of the most important levelers I've ever had. I think it really, really kept my feet firmly rooted to the ground, and it's almost impossible for them to ever leave it now. And
did you know it would be when you signed up to do it?
No, not at all. I think I was a bit naive, really. You know, I went online one day, just started to, you know, I thought, oh, I think I should go and do a challenge. It'd be quite fun. I think I'd seen those posters for the round the world sailing, the Clipper Challenge. I kind of liked the idea of that, but it was quite a lot of people. It felt a tiny bit commercial. I wanted something that was just a bit grittier. Saw that mm-hmm. people rode across the Atlantic and signed up. And it was as simple as that. I just thought, again, it was in the period of literal travel. I just saw it as, yeah, that sounds fun. Let's row the Atlantic. I didn't think about the nuance of emotions. And that came very swiftly. Oh my goodness. You know, that first week on that ocean was the most miserable period of my life, probably.
Wow.
I never wanted to be somewhere less in my life. I think a lot of travels like that, I think a lot of people, if they're very honest, it's not all enjoyable. And that might be the journey to get there. It might be the loneliness. It might be illness along the way. It might be the things you've seen. It might be the inequality that you're exposed to. You know, a lot of travel is not necessarily enjoyable, and a lot of it, let's be honest, can be distinctly unenjoyable. But again, it's part of the light and shade that is so important in life. You have to have ups and downs, and certainly that row across the Atlantic, I think naively thought it would just be a good boy's own tough challenge, and I didn't think about how much I cried a lot on that ocean.
And what were the things that were really triggering your emotions?
Everything, kind of thinking what an idiot I was getting myself into this position in the first place, because I had no one to blame. You know, mums are always sensible, and mum thought it was a ridiculous idea. I just had her always in my head going, well, don't come crying to me. You wanted to do this. You signed up. You told everyone how brave and clever you were, that you were going to try and row the Atlantic. And that's kind of how I saw this. So actually a lot of the tears were, why did you do this? And I think a lot of your listeners who've traveled and have experienced that will recognize that emotion, because you'll have that when you've got a terrible bout of diarrhea, which incidentally, no travel diary would be complete without mention of bowel. I haven't had
absolutely
or sickness while traveling for 25 years now. And I think it's because I got it all out of my system in the first 5 years when I started. on the loo. But it is amazing how you really do build up an immunity. I like to think that I have the best constitution. I literally don't get sick now when I travel.
That's a real bonus.
I've got a rock solid constitution. But anyway, to avoid disappearing off on a completely different tangent, my point many people will have had that stuck in a room with the worst tummy ache and diarrhea known to man, thinking, why did we come out to this place? It's horrid. And I had that on that boat, and I just cried and just thought, why did I tell everyone I was going to do this? Because, of course, if I hadn't told everyone, if I wasn't in the public eye and made a big song and dance, we could have probably quietly turned that boat around and gone back, and it'd have been a bit embarrassing with friends, but we'd have just gone, oh, yeah, we were a bit stupid, weren't we? And got on with it. But this was very public, and I couldn't get away with it. And then combine that with sleep deprivation, hunger, homesickness. I suffered terrible, terrible homesickness. I wasn't married at that stage. Marina, who's now my wife, was my girlfriend. It was the early stages of our relationship. And actually, we'd only known each other for about 6 months. And moving ahead to when we finally got across that finish line, I actually proposed to her a day later. I think that gave me a moment to reflect on what I had in life, where I had come from, where I was going, and I have no regrets about the decisions I made after rowing across the Atlantic. So in that sense, the Atlantic really was my greatest teacher.
Mm. And then from there, your list of achievements and challenges that you've completed are utterly extraordinary. Skiing across the South Pole, crossing Oman's Empty Quarter, and most recently climbing Mount Everest. All in their own right, such incredible achievements. Is there one that you feel most proud of?
Well, I think, again, a lot of those, I thank you for kind of bigging them up. They're not actually, do you know what? I kind of, more of it is the opportunity I have and seizing the opportunity. There'll be many listeners who will be going, you lucky, lucky man. I have seized on those opportunities that have come my way. So I know it sounds big and clever to walk to the South Pole, but actually half of it is just about having the opportunity to do it. And I've always been acutely aware of that. So I'm trying now to be a humble traveler, not one of those when eyes was the reference I always was always told when I was in. I did a bit of time as a reserve in the Royal Navy, and people would always roll their eyes when I came up to you. When I was in Oman, when I was in the Falklands. And I try to not be one of those kind of travelers. But I think a lot of the travel experiences have been about where I was in my life. And Everest was a kind of really interesting time because I was a father to Ludo and Iona, who were at the time 6 and 8. And I was sort of missing out a lot on their childhood, but also I had kind of stopped doing some of the slightly riskier travel. I had become a bit more steadfast in the travel that I was doing, and I'd reached this point where it didn't feel like I was being the real me. I didn't think I was being an honest father by telling them to follow their dreams and pursue their goals and their ambitions. And yes, I wasn't doing it. So Everest kind of came at the right time. And it, contrary to what you might read in the papers, that it's now just a commercial venture where you chuck loads of money at it and you get hauled to the top by some underpaid, exploited Sherpas. It's not that. And I think part of the attraction was to try and dismiss or validate those cliches or those stereotypes of it. Mm. And I wanted to see for myself, is it still a challenge? Is it true that people just chuck money and they're dragged to the top? You know, I really wanted to try and get to the bottom of it. I like to consider myself a storyteller. And as a traveler, or a journeyman, which is my preferred sort of title, I suppose. I like to think that I go to places or meet people or experience things. And then I get to translate them on in the spoken word, like here on this podcast or in the books I write or in the TV shows I make. So Everest was almost an experiment as well as an expedition. And I think standing on the top, which was the culmination of great teamwork, the Sherpas undoubtedly are the heroes of the mountains. And I wouldn't have even got near to the summit without their incredible friendship, support, teamwork, all of those things. But, and this is the point, Everest is still a great challenge for a great many people. And for me, I think it was the pinnacle of the experiences I've had over the years. It was almost like putting everything into play. Living on that island for a year, the travel in South America, the immersion, living with people in the wilderness, crossing Antarctica, all those things that we've touched on today, I think were my lessons and my apprenticeship leading up to the culmination of my lifelong dream, which was to stand on the top of Mount Everest.
I really love the concept that from a learning perspective, Everest was the pinnacle of your travel diaries. I remember Sir Ranulph Fiennes on season one describing Everest in a similar way, actually. And you said it was a lifelong dream, a childhood fascination.
I've always loved travel books. I've always loved travel literature. Mm. I've got a huge library of travel guides, travel books, new, old. And certainly as a child, I used to, you know, I loved National Geographic magazines. And I remember looking at old copies of National Geographic with those great expeditions of the 60s, 70s and 80s and just marveling at them. And I suppose where other friends of mine idolized footballers or musicians, you know, I idolized the mountaineers, the climbers. And I remember reading lots of the early mountaineering books and just marveling at them, you know, just think in wonder, the bravery of those individuals. And I never thought that Everest would even come into my world. And it did through a series of opportunities. Kenton Cool, veteran of 12 climbs at the time, became a friend. He always said that if the time was ever right and I wanted to have a go, that he would help guide me. And again, it was a series of events that led to it. And I was able to kind of fulfill a real childhood dream.
And I've always wondered, when you're in the midst of it and you're going through this enormous physical challenge of summiting a mountain like Everest, are you able to take in the scenery? Are you able to take in the tremendous beauty around you? Or is your headspace just in a completely different place?
Well, this is why I think I say that Everest for me was the culmination of everything. I think it was the right time. I think controversially, I think Everest isn't for everyone. I think you need to be in the right headspace to climb Mount Everest. I really do. I think it's more than just a physical challenge. I think you need to really know yourself. And because I really did know myself at that point of climbing, it meant that I wasn't lost in my own world of suffering and fear, which many people are, or arrogance, you know, actually, let's be honest about Everest. I think a number of people take on challenges like that with their own self-belief and arrogance, which you need a sense of, but you want confidence rather than arrogance. Whereas I went there with an honest confidence that I could do this, that I had the best team, that I was in the best mental place. And it meant that I could enjoy the landscape around me rather than dwelling on fear, summit fever. That's this obsession people have with the goal, the destination. I went there with this very strong sense of belief that the journey was the mission. That I had, if I didn't, my wife, it was actually part of the deal with the family. My wife said to me, listen, if you don't make it to the top, and the chances were very high that I wouldn't, and you come back, we don't want you moping around the house in a depression because you haven't been there. That's not the point. That's not fair for us. I think it was a very fair point that she made. She said, listen, we are letting you go on this quite selfish expedition. I think there was a selfishness in it. But the deal is, if you come back, even if you haven't made it, you have to have enjoyed the experience. And that was pretty profound, I think, for me, because I think a lot of people do go on these things and they just focus on that destination, the goal. If you go to Peru and you don't make it to Machu Picchu, it's a failure. Well, things happen. Places close, weather turns. There are all sorts of things that can prevent you from reaching that goal. But if you can enjoy every moment up to that, then it's not lost, it's not wasted, it's not a failure. So I did, I could enjoy everything. And for me, the whole standing on the summit of Everest, of course, was an amazing, incredible, life-changing, unforgettable moment. But the whole thing was life-changing. I loved every single minute of it. This is a strange thing. I wouldn't go back to do it again because I dodged a bullet. You know, it is a risky venture, and I just don't think it would be fair on the family. And yes, I would go back in an instant because I have such fond, happy memories that I would. So in a weird kind of way, I'm kind of drawn and repelled at the same time.
And keeping on the same vein here, from Everest, your all-time favourite adventure, to Chapter 4, your all-time favourite destination. So hard when you've travelled so extensively, I know.
All-time favourite destination. Well, it really is hard, but I'm going to say Cornwall. I think a lot of people, when they look at travel, especially when we're looking at from the vision of UK listeners, you look at travel meaning far away, exotic, overseas places. And for me, I've always been a big champion of the British Isles. I love this country. I've traveled a huge amount here. In the early days of my work, I really did. I almost touched every single point. And I know every single beach, every mountain, every national park, every remote region, every visitor.
Wonderful.
And Cornwall for me has always, and Devon actually, so I'm going to actually throw their neighbours into the fray there. The Southwest for me is a very happy, happy place. I went there quite a lot as a child. We as a family return every year. And I think there's something, that there is just something that brings us closer to our island geography, our maritime history. There's something quintessentially British for me about the Southwest. I think Cornwall and Devon, with its rugged coastline, its big weather, its big wild beaches, for me is my favourite place.
One of my all-time favourites too, and a regular on this podcast actually. From popular destinations to the path less trodden, Chapter 5 is your hidden gem. Another tough one for you, Ben. I feel like we could dedicate an entire episode to this alone.
Hidden gems, there's so many, but let's just get one out there. I think I'm going to go for Ethiopia. I've been lucky enough to go to Ethiopia a few times. I was a child, I was born in the early 70s. I was a child of the 80s when Live Aid was there, the Great Famine hit Ethiopia. And I certainly grew up with this very strong image that Ethiopia was all starving people and barren, dried earth. And the first time I went, I discovered the complete opposite of that. One of the happiest, friendliest places, great opportunity, thriving city, amazing coffee, and what really surprised me, so much greenery, rich forestry, great culture. And again, just going back to the people, I have rarely met such happy, such generous, such warm, such beautiful people as the Ethiopians. And my first visit was actually to make a show about a terrible disease that affects people in sub-Saharan Africa. But aside to that, we spent a lot of time in Addis Ababa in the city. I'm not a huge city fan, but I actually really, really enjoyed being in Addis. And then I have returned a number of times, most recently last year, to go to Lalibela, the great stone churches, cut the rock in the ground. I mean, that really is one of the most astonishing sights I've ever seen.
God, I'd love to go there, Ben. Was it just unbelievable?
Oh, it really, you know, I've been lucky enough to visit most of the great kind of man-made wonders of the world. And for me, Lalibela, during a religious ceremony where everyone is wearing their white robes, it actually makes me quite tearful just thinking about it now. It is truly one of the most extraordinary, beautiful, moving, photogenic things I have ever seen. Just the right light. You don't need to be religious to be profoundly moved by it. It really was truly amazing. But again, just back to Ethiopia as a very, very exciting travel destination, especially for families, is high on my list.
And is it an easy destination for travellers, would you say?
Very easy. Yeah. I mean, getting there perhaps maybe is a slightly more complex place. Like many regions in the world, you need to be sensible about road travel. Yeah, I think it's fair to say that road travel is one of the more dangerous aspects of travel almost everywhere in the world. And I always like to reiterate to people, they always think that the dangers will be with people that you might come across who might rob you or mug you. Well, I can tell you road traffic accidents are the thing I'm always more fearful of. But I think once, if you can reach Addis Ababa, certainly reaching the different regions from there is relatively straightforward. There's good accommodation. I think the food is very exciting. A lot of your listeners who've been there may be making a retching noise. There's something called, and forgive me if I've got the wrong pronunciation, but injera bread, which a lot of people describe as carpet liner. It's sort of it's got that texture. It's quite spongy. It's got holes in it. It's kind of bitter, very, very bitter. And I personally love the stuff. I actually proactively go to Ethiopian restaurants in London and else in New York when I'm there, because I find the food tibs and the variety that you have very exciting. And the people, again, I just can't reiterate enough how amazing and beautiful. I don't like to use this thing beauty very often, but both the men and the women in Ethiopia just take your breath away, because they are so strikingly beautiful. And I've had so many fascinating conversations, and again, not wanting to use brush strokes, but I think a lot of Ethiopians are frustrated that a lot of people still have these cliches of that period of great famine, which was terrible for Ethiopia. And I don't doubt there is still famine in different regions, but it doesn't mark a whole region forever and ever. It's much more than just the sum of those parts.
Well, I'm sold, Ben. That's firmly added to my travel wish list. It sounds just so wonderful. In contrast then, chapter 6 is your worst travel experience.
For me, travel is about what you take away from it. Mm-hmm. And I've been to places that are hard. I've been to places that are wretched. I've been to places that aren't really me. So I've been to Ayia Napa. I don't think Ayia Napa is my kind of place. You know, I ended up, for one reason or another, in a little kind of bed and breakfast between two super clubs. And it really was not my favorite place. But would I go back? yes, if circumstances took me there. But the same could be said for somewhere like Haiti. I went there shortly after the devastating earthquake, and the only way to describe it is wretched. It was one of the hardest places I've ever been. There's rarely a place where I almost felt overwhelmed with how on earth they were ever going to rebuild. And naturally, there was quite a lot of anger. There was a lot of there was a lot of frustration there. It wasn't the warmest of places, but I totally understand why that would be the general sentiment. Mm-hmm. Again, would I race back there? I think probably not, mainly because it's inappropriate. But I also, to say inappropriate would be detrimental to those who rely on tourism, who want people like me to visit places like Port-au-Prince and Haiti. So I think the general answer to this is there were places that weren't really me. There were places that I felt might be inappropriate to visit, and there were places that left me genuinely sad. And Haiti really was one of those, because rarely have I felt beaten by a place in that I couldn't see quite how they were ever going to pick themselves up again. But that is also a great attraction for me, and actually I would love to return and see whether my own sentiments were correct, and I'd like to think that the islanders and the island itself has proved me wrong and actually has started to rebuild a lot of those earthquake ravaged, disease ridden places.
Haiti as a country has had such a horrendous time, hasn't it? But as you say, I just hope it can prove us all wrong and, you know, slowly start to recover. Continuing with that theme of looking forward, chapter 7 is your next big adventure. Are you always looking for a new challenge?
I think there'll always be something. I'm kind of I like to be driven by a carrot, and a carrot can be a big challenge. It might just be a place I want to go. It might be something I would like to achieve. And travel is my favorite thing in the world. Like I say, it's my oxygen. So I I get very excited by travel. And travel is, for me, leaving my own house. So it's something that we have largely been deprived of for the last 3-4 months. And I can't wait to just leave my house and go and explore a little bit, beginning in this country. But of the bigger challenges, Everest was certainly a pinnacle, but it won't be the last. And I think a notion of traveling and journeying around the world using self-propulsion somehow, whether that's walking, running, cycling, sailing, ballooning, whatever it is, I think this notion of actually journeying all the way around the world in a green means is very exciting. And I'd be surprised if at some stage an opportunity didn't arise. I don't think it's going to be right now. I kind of owe it to my children. They're reaching an age where they really need me around and I want to be around. But I think as soon as they fledge the nest, when they head off to university or whatever they choose to do after their schooling, I think will be the moment when I might try something like that. And that always excited me, this notion that the world is a giant place, but actually we can do it on with our own legs or arms or using the weather around us.
What a fantastic idea. You call yourself a journeyman, a storyteller, and I think that circumnavigating the world with zero emissions is a really important story that needs to be told. So I'm looking forward to that happening one day. So now we're on to the final chapter of your travel diaries, Ben, chapter 8, which is the destination at the top of your travel bucket list.
Blimey, I mean, that really is a difficult one. Believe it or not, Holly, there are loads and loads of places I have still never been. There are lots of things I haven't experienced. There are people I haven't met. So I actually have quite a lot of ultimate bucket list experiences. I've never been to China, anywhere in China. The Great Wall, wow, I'd love to see that. I'd love to go to the Great Wall of China. I've never been to the North Pole. I'd quite like to do that with the children. So my bucket list is there's a few places on it. So I'm answering now, by the way. I'm not kind of just doing a politician's answer, putting it off, but multiple ones. I think for me, doing stuff with my own children, introducing them to different regions of the world, different lifestyles, I think it's really important to them, for me to show them how privileged they are. You know, I'm acutely aware of the life that they have been born into, which is not one that the majority of the world is. And I want them to be as rounded as possible. Mm. So I want to expose them to how the world really is. And I think we'll do that through a series of immersions, a series of visits, a series of adventures, just to remind them to keep their feet firmly on the ground, never take themselves, their health, the food they have on their plate for granted. And I think to do that takes a series of little expeditions. So in all seriousness, I'd love to go to the South Pole with them. And we will do that without doubt at some stage. If the ice allows it, unfortunately. Well, may preclude that. Maybe they will never be able to get there. Maybe we'll have to paddle there. But I would like to, I think my bucket list is now about making them as rounded as possible and giving them opportunities that will build their character, their personalities, and hopefully their selflessness. Because I don't like selfish people. And I think if you aren't open-minded enough, you're in danger of becoming selfish. I think the key to being selfless is to travel.
What a great way to end. Thank you so much, Ben. Those were your incredible travel diaries. It's been so wonderful to get to hear them.
It's been a great opportunity to tell you about and show off about all of my travels. So thank you.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Ben Fogle for the first or the second time. Like Simon Reeve last week, I'm sure you'll agree that Ben should probably come back and join us for another episode sometime. He's just been to such remote, unusual parts of the world, and I really love hearing him talk about travel. Next week is our big season finale. Dame Joanna Lumley joins us for the whole hour, and let me tell you, this is going to be one of your favourites. I know it. So I'll see you next week, everyone. Take care. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb super host. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.